Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 18, delivered on October 27, 2016. The title of this lecture is Investment Decisions in Practice.
Investment Decisions in Practice. As I had told you before, oddly, even though the internal rate of return method is flawed and not as desirable as the net present value method, it is actually used in practice quite a bit. In fact, in my own experience, I saw internal rate of return was just very common. The net present value approach was not as common, and the reason was this. With the net present value approach, you need a discount rate to put in to bring your cash flows back. That discount rate has to be pulled from somewhere. And it's probably not a good idea to pull it out of thin air. There is a way to do it. It's called the capital asset pricing model. However, most companies would prefer not to do that. I'm going to show you very quickly, before I move on, the capital asset pricing model. It works like this. If you want to know a discount rate for something, for a cash flow, for using for figuring out a stock price for the K, whatever, the capital asset pricing model says that the discount rate you use should be the risk-free rate, which we usually proxy with a short-term treasury bill, plus the beta of the security, or whatever it is, times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. That's the capital asset pricing model. Now, so if I wanted to find out what discount rate to use for use net present values for a project, I would use this model. But the beta that I would need to use would be the project beta. That's where it gets difficult a little bit. How do I find the beta of a project? Now, I can find the beta of a stock. I just look on a screen to find the beta of a stock. But how do I find the beta of a project? Couple of ways. One of the most popular ways, if you're going to do it this way, is to actually find a company that specializes in things just like your project. You're a big multinational company. You've got a project. Let's say it's something like an aircraft engine project. So what you would want to do is go out and find a company that specializes in building aircraft engines and use its beta to figure out the project beta for your project. That's how you would do it in practice. Now, I'm bringing this up right now just to point out that, again, you have the net present value method and you have the internal rate of return method for project decision making. The NPV method is superior, but it relies on having a discount rate to use to bring back the cash flows. That's where the capital asset pricing model comes in. Now, I'm going to take this off the board because I'm not, that comes next week, I show you that. More fully. Okay. The big problem with the internal rate of return, there are a couple of problems with it. One of the big problems, though, is that if you have cash flow switching back and forth, the internal rate of return gives you spurious values. In other words, if you've got a simple project where there's an initial cash outflow, and then there are cash inflows, then the NPV function is a nice clean thing, and right there is your internal rate of return. Okay? Really nice. Low discount rates, you'll have a positive NPV. High discount rates, you'll have a high discount rates, you'll have a negative NPV as the cash flows are more steeply discounted. And the point where from positive to negative, that's the internal rate of return of the project. Now, and again though, the problem is that if the project switches cash flow more than one time, the NPV function looks like this, and the internal rate of return, you'll get multiple IRRs. And your calculator will say, here's the IRR, but that's the only reason it'll give you a certain answer is because it will begin searching here, and it'll find this one, or it'll start searching here, and it'll find this one. So you really got nothing with IRR. So here's, but there is a way around this, and it's a... It has that slightly phony smell to it, but it's been popular for years and years and years because you've got companies that just won't give up the idea of an internal rate of return. So what they do is instead of going to the NPV, a technique has been developed to straighten out the IRR so that instead of having this kinked whipsaw, it actually straightens it. It's called MIRR, Modified Internal Rate of Return. You would not use this unless you have more than one switch in the cash flow sign. It's actually kind of, it's not all that hard in practice. CF0, CF1, CF2, cash flow. And I'm just going to draw one abstractly here, and then I'll show you how you do it. Now, let me bring this up. There are several variants on the MIRR approach. Okay. This one, and again, I think the book shows you more than one, but here. Suppose you got your typical classical negative cash outflow at the beginning. Spend money to start the project. Okay, and then you have a couple of years of positive cash flows, and then you're going to have to throw money into the project to make it go national, to replace a lot of things that break down early on, and or you have to you learn more about how the equipment should work, and you put money into it, so you got a negative cash flow here. Then you got a couple of positive cash flows out to the end, okay? Here's how the modified internal rate of return works. What you have to do is you get a discount rate, the cost of equity capital of the firm, and then you take your negative cash flows all back to the present value right now. Then you take a negative present value. You find the present value of your negative cash flows. Then you take your positive cash flows out to the end of the project as a future value. And if this is looking tedious, it is. And it's really, it does have the smell of phony, but it's popular. Okay, now, once you've done that, you've got a negative present value at the front end, you've got a positive present value, future value at the back end, and then you key it into a calculator or whatever you do and find the internal rate of return for a CF0 that is this value, 0000 cash flow, and then one final positive giant cash flow out at the terminus of the project. And you find the internal rate of return that makes this thing zero as a net present value. Okay. Total blank on that. Watch. Watch this. Let me put some numbers in here. Okay. Let's say the project costs initially $5,000 up front. right off the bat. Okay, then you're going to get 1,000 and let's say 2,000, but then you got to put in money, another 3,000 you've got to put into it. But once you've done that, you get 5,000 and 4,000. Oh, let's do this. 3,000. That should work a little better. Okay, that's what your project's cash flow profile will look like. You kick in $5,000, and for that you're going to get a couple of years of money. But then you're going to have to put in some more money to keep the engines going, to modify things, to upgrade, and then you're going to get a couple more years of positive out of it. Okay, let's suppose that your cost of capital, cost of equity capital to fund this project is going to be, let's say, 8.4%. 8.4%. See if I can actually pull this off. So the first thing that I'm going to need to do is I'm going to need to find the present values of these two put together. So that'd be the negative $5,000 plus negative $3,000 discounted back 3 periods. I got the $5,000 that I kick out right away, and then I got another $3,000 out here 3 years in the future. So I'm going to find the total present value of my expenditures on the project. And doing that, let me take that $3,000 times 1.084 to the negative third power. Okay, that really sucked. Let's try that again. I have $3,000 times 1.084 y to the x. Oh, God, that's right. This is not a scientific calculator. Oh, God. Okay, 3,000 times 1.084 to the negative third power. Where's the negative button? Oh. $2,355.23. So that would come out to be a total of $7,355. Okay, that is the negative cash flow. That is the present value of the costs of the project. Now what I'm going to do is I am going to find the future values out here of the positive cash flows of the project. Now this is where our timeline is going to really help you out, because I've got 1,000, 1, 2, 3, 4. So I'm going to grow the 1,000 4 periods into the future. 1,000 times 1 plus 0.084 to the fourth power plus 2,000, 1, 2, 3, grown 3 periods into the future, and then 5,000 grown 1 period into the future, and then this terminal $3,000 at the end. So that I pack all of the positive cash flows out to the end of the project. And if it's looking confusing to you, no, you're not alone here. But for God's sake, someone please go with me as I try to get this right the first time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, all right, 1,000 times 1.084 to the fourth power plus 2,000 times 1.084 to the third power plus 5,000 times 1.08. Oh God, oh God, well, oh God. There. Oh, that just pissed me off. I'm sorry. I know. Yeah. Okay. It's minus 5,000. I was trying to be so smooth there on that. Yep, I sure did. Okay, now plus 5,000 times 1.0. Really? Times 1.084. I'll get this right here, folks. 0.084 plus, and then that 3,000 there right at the end equals. So I got $12,348.28. $12,348.27. And now, for the end of this nonsense, we're going to get this off the board. And now what we're going to do is we're going to reset everything, and we're going to do a cash flow. The cash flow at period zero, what is that number over there? Thank you. Posneg. Okay, now, down. No cash flow. Down. For how many periods is there no cash flow? 1, 2, 3, 4. 4 periods, no cash flow. Huh? What did I do? I do. How could I? How the heck did that happen? Zero. Really? Let's try that one more time. Cash flow. Okay. 7,355. What was it? 0.23. Posneg. Okay, so now down one. So now we're going to have a zero cash flow for 4 periods. Really? For 4 periods. Am I doing something wrong, or is this calculator really, really having some kind of a mental issue? Okay, let me try it one more time. Okay, cash flow, 7,355.23, Posneg. Okay, enter that. Go down. Now. The cash flow at period one is zero. When I hit zero, it gives me that. My plan for resetting this is to bust the thing. Zero. Down. Okay, fine. And then I want that for four periods. But when I hit four, look what happens. Say what? Okay, so I'm going to just go down, zero, enter. Down, enter, down, enter, okay, for one period, good. Now, on the fifth period, is it? One, two, three, four, five, was that the fifth period or the sixth period?
You do four zeros.
One, two, three, four, five, yeah, four zeros. Okay, so I've got four. One more zero to do, down. Well, that was certainly a lot less enjoyable, okay. And then for the cash flow for the last one is 12, 3, 4, 8, 28. 12, 3, seriously? Is it, this thing is on crack. 12. This is just. I did. Ah! One more time, and then I quit. Okay, one more time. What was the initial cash flow? $355. I should have had it memorized by now. 0.23. Negative. Enter. Down. Now, the cash flow for period one is zero, down. Frequency of one, down. Cash flow zero, down. Cash flow zero, down. Cash flow zero, down. I had four zeros. Now, I come to this one, and I want to put in 12, 3, 48, 28. 12, 3, 48, 28. Okay, and then down one. Now, compute the internal rate of return. There. 10.92%. Now, you saw me do this a couple of times, but it might have just been this computer here. But I get a 10.92%. That was way too much like work to get that. Here's the upshot. Should I take the project or not? What was my cost of equity? My cost of equity was 8.4%. What was the return on the project? 10.92. There you go. Thank God I finally got to the end. It's actually, trust me, it's not as hard as it looked there. That was just that calculator. But once you've gotten to the point where the problem with this method, if you'll notice, is that you do need the cost of equity. But that's something separate. That's a separate finance issue, is what your cost of equity is. Now, typically, one of the problems, of course, would be that your cost of equity is usually kind of high. So this makes for a tough time for projects to make this one. And I had actually, to be honest with you, I had done this project. I set this problem up last night. I wasn't expecting this calculator to give me this attitude. But I used a relatively low cost of equity, a very safe, stable corporation. And I set it up so that I would get a decent little spread. And the modified internal rate of return method actually is valid. I mean, theoretically, it works. And it is how companies get around the problem of these discount rates that are too high. These cash flows that switch signs back and forth. Now, here's a couple of issues that I have to bring up here. One is when you have mutually exclusive projects. Mutually exclusive projects. In other words, you've got two different things that you could do, but you can't do both of them because of some physical limitation. Like, for example, you have a, well, you want to build a factory, or you want to build a distribution facility, but you've got one piece of land. You can do one or the other. So in other words, in traditional finance, we would just say take all projects that have positive NPVs or whatever. But in a situation like this, it's obvious what you do. You take the project with the higher NPV. It's just a simple rule. If you can't do both things, then you just take the one with the higher NPV. However, here's a weird thing, and I thought when I learned this back many years ago about net present values and all this, I thought, well, when would you ever see this possibly happen? Well, I actually ran into one rather earlier in my consulting. You had NPV and IRR. These are actually... The NPVs were almost... And the IRRs were... These weren't exactly the numbers, and these were in tens of thousands of dollars, I think. It's been so many years since that happened. But now, they were mutually exclusive projects. The company could not do both of these projects. And running the numbers, which was what I did for them, I came up with the net present values that told me project two. But the internal rate of returns told me project one. They came up with exactly conflicting decisions. And if that happens to you, your best way to do it is just say, okay, I am always going to take one over the other. And if I'm looking at the theoretical background of these two methods, NPV is a stronger method, so I'm just going to say NPV tells me to take project two, and even though internal rate of return tells me project one, NPV is a stronger method theoretically, and so we'll just go with the theory of it and say that's the one we take on a project where there is mutual exclusivity. And again, though, it is rare, but I ran into it surprisingly early on in my consulting, a project that happened to have that in it. Now, next thing. I mentioned, and I don't want to, I hate going into this in so much detail because it really is kind of a flawed methodology. You know, nothing is going right here today. There. I hope that holds because I think this marker is at its end. Okay. Now, a company establishes a hurdle rate and says any project that exceeds this hurdle rate, any project that exceeds the hurdle rate as far as internal rate of return is concerned, we take that project. If any project does not exceed that hurdle rate, then we reject that project. Companies use hurdle rates. It's very popular to use them. They just have you run the internal rates of return, and then you just compare to the hurdle rate the company has for its projects. Here's the thing about it. What hurdle rate would you use if you wanted to be a little bit less than just completely arbitrary? Arbitrary, you just pull an internal rate of return out of thin air. If you wanted to be a little bit more realistic about what hurdle rate you should use, let's try this. During a recession, would you want to have a high hurdle rate or a low hurdle rate for projects during a recessionary period?
My understanding
is low. Say that again?
Low.
Actually, you are exactly right. The temptation would be for management to want to have a high hurdle rate. But that is exactly what you don't want to do in bad times. You see, when times are bad, your temptation is to go long. What they used to call in football the Hail Mary pass. We also know that investors do this. It is contrary to economic theory of rational behavior. Rational behavior says that people in defensive times will get defensive. They will hoard, they will back down, they will protect themselves. But we know from looking at investors, but also we know that companies do this too. They follow a behavioral pattern which we have come to call prospect theory. Prospect theory, by traditional economics, is irrational. But it's what companies do. So you are right. And if you were in a management position, you would have to really fight. Here's prospect theory. And have any of you ever been to a casino? Okay. It's one thing you'll see, and it's a human behavior. When you see someone losing, you'll see them keep playing. When someone wins, you see them pretty much quit. Or really back down. Winning makes you become intelligent. You know that it was a random thing. You weren't blessed by God or anything like that. You just won. So you take your earnings and you either leave or you put most of it in your pocket and you play with some mad money off the winnings. But when you are losing, you will just keep beating and pounding and hammering. It's a slot machine. You'll just keep putting the coins in. I will win. I will win. If it's a lottery ticket, I lost this week. Well, I'm going to go next week and do it again and again and again. In other words, the desire of a company or the desire of a person to make up a loss, which is fallacious and wrong and illogical, overwhelms the better sense, which is to back down, to play it safe. So in a recessionary environment, a company is going to think that you're going to have you'll have to fight it. The company's management will think that the way we survive is to take risk, to go long, which is why we have the magnification of bankruptcies in recessions. Bankruptcies are going to be part of recessions, but they are magnified by the fact that companies tend to decide, okay, we're in a bad position, so we're just going to throw the money to the wind and see what comes out. Hope for the best. We've lost on the last three hands at 21. Well, let's just go for broke this time. Literally, go for broke. And you see companies do this all the time. And it's why we have this magnification. We have more bankruptcies during recessions than we would expect by business models that we know. Well, you know, it wasn't that bad, the recession wasn't, but look at all these companies that went bankrupt. That's because these companies saw the difficulties that they were facing and they thought that their best bet was to take an incredible risk or take risk. And of course, when you take risk, you're going to probably get hurt doing the risk, especially if you do it in desperation, which a lot of companies do in their last, in their death throes. They go desperate instead of backing down, going back to the core business and just riding from there. Another process. Some of the longest standing companies, retail companies in the U.S., were not companies that made their fortune off a single product. You hear about that too much in business. The true success stories in business have been companies that stayed very much on a modest, conservative growth path as far as products go and as far as their growth of their store chains goes. There is a, for example, what is one of the longest standing restaurant chains in the U.S.? Does anyone know? Yeah? White Castle. White Castle. I mean, you go there for cramps. Yeah, I don't go there. It's a good, you might say, oh, I hate that place. It makes me have diarrhea or whatever. But at the same time, this place, they don't innovate. They just have their burgers. They have this way that they've cooked them for decades and decades. They have a business model, and it works. They don't go long. They slowly grow. And they don't try lots of fancy new products in any given time period, but it survives. And the way they do that is by simply saying, we actually don't want these projects out here. This is our exclusion zone. We have a hurdle rate in here, but we don't look for projects out in here. Other companies that survived for decades, and unfortunately they just got a little too sloppy with it, but they survived for many decades, were companies like SS Cresci, Kmart, and companies like that, because they were able to hold on. They did not try for long balls in any kind of recessionary environment. They just kept their basic business model. Candy companies are exactly the same. They don't try to innovate on these high hurdle rate projects. They don't put a high hurdle rate out here. They put a low hurdle rate so that they don't exclude conservative projects. Now, I have to run down and get the op scans. I left them in my office, and then I'll come back and you'll do your quiz, and that'll be all I have for you today, okay?